Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. Ted, welcome back to the show and welcome back to Canada after a nice little trip, I understand, to Japan.
Well, thank you, Jim. Yes, spring break in Japan hadn't been in a few years because of COVID, but nice to see how things are doing over in that part of the world. And basically, as soon as we got on the plane to go to Japan, the U.S. financial system started to wobble. And we had our little mini banking crisis, I guess. So that's always fun to try and keep tabs on when you're
Did you manage to get any reaction from people in Japan to what's happening to the banking system in the U.S. and, as we found out, also in Switzerland?
Jim, it just wasn't top of mind. I mean, this is just very interesting. You know, the Western media, our European, American media are really focused on sort of the U.S. dollar centric view of the world, where I just get the sense that events are kind of really racing ahead here. And in Asia, there's a lot more concern about what's going on with China, North Korea, it's a different set of priorities, I think, in terms of people's attention. And, you know, the cost of living issue, though, is something that they have in common in Japan with us here. And so that's, one of the issues, or if not the issue, that probably we have in common with them right now. The U.S. banking system problems were not top of mind, but the inflation sure was.
And also with the Japanese, because they had a banking crisis after the Second World War, the Japanese people still buy safes that they can install in a closet or in their floorboards. They call it closet money. And cash for a lot of them is still king because they don't trust the banks. Maybe they've been right to do that all along.
Well, certainly I think in Japan, cash is still used a fair amount compared to even China, which has now kind of raced ahead here on payments and the like. Inflation is certainly an issue, I think, now in Japan, and it is an issue here. And I think, from what we're seeing in terms of what's happened with the U.S. banking system, when it's now basically it is the victim of the Fed's mismanagement of monetary policy in terms of managing the inflation in the U.S., the U.S. banking system has become the victim here, as far as what I can decipher from all of this. I think the inflation story in the U.S. is not done by any stretch. I'm bewildered to see commentators, I don't know if it's wishful thinking or spinning, that they're doing at the behest of people in powerful places or whatever, but I've been getting this spin, well, inflation's rolling over, I just don't think the job has been done there, and now the American system is feeling the impact of these rate hikes. And so I just want to, maybe we can just put this out there, you know, to begin with, in terms of trying to set the stage for how we see insiders positioning in North America. But look, there's this narrative that's being pushed on the media that this was a problem with a few banks that have been mismanaged and there's not a big problem. I think that is wrong. And I'll tell you why I think that is wrong. Because look, there are just over 4,200 banking institutions in the U.S. And look, they're not all going to have the same business model. They're not all going to have the same breakdown of depositors, you know, insured versus uninsured. So this narrative that, oh, well, this bank was poorly run and this bank was mismanaged, yeah, you're always going to have a dispersion of competencies in these banks. But the fact of the matter is that there are incompetent banks fail all the time. But now, all of a sudden, it's happening all at once? Really? Like all of a sudden, all these banks, why is that? Why is this happening now? And the other reason why I think that this is nonsense, all these problems are just idiosyncratic, this is one or two bad apples, is that, well, okay, then why is First Republic, having some problems? Are they mismanaged? And you always, you know, and no, well, they're not mismanaged. Okay, well, then why are they having some problems? Like, why is there an issue there? And I'll tell you why there's an issue generally, and I'm not talking about any one institution. I'm not a bank analyst, so I'm in no way going to try and talk about any one particular bank. But just generally, what happened in my view, was that the Fed is responsible for both monetary policy and bank supervision in the U.S. And we all know they dropped the ball on monetary policy because in 2021, they were talking about lower for longer. We're going to keep rates. We're not even thinking about raising rates. The dot plot was like, you know, rate hikes and, you know, maybe sometime in the future. But guess what? The Fed is also the supervisor of banks. So all these people on Twitter and on business televisions that come on and say, oh, well, these banks should have hedged. Oh, really? Oh, really? So they should have just basically bet against their regulator. And hedging does have costs. It's not free, to hedge interest rate risk. So basically, all these commentators we hear on in the media and on social media, basically trying to let the Fed off the hook here, are saying, well, these banks should have just basically bet against their regulator and incurred the cost to do that. Oh, really? Right now, if that's not rear view mirror driving, I don't know what is. Like, that is just absolutely ridiculous. And anyone who's pushing that line, you really should have, I think, a high degree of skepticism towards, right? Like, where are they coming from on this? Why are they talking this position? The fact of the matter is, the Fed told these banks back in 2021, they didn't think they were going to raise rates. They dropped rates to zero. So people put their deposits on the banks. The banks, what were they going to do? They have their costs to cover. They can't just sit there with money in the bank, in their bank and not trying to recover their costs. They have to invest the money somewhere. So they went into credit risk-free treasuries, right? And so the treasuries went down in value once the Fed panicked over inflation because they were asleep at the switch, right? And Jerome Powell, as we talked about in the show a month ago, started his war on the American worker because, you know, it was the American workers who were the evil people in all of this because they were going to demand raises and this was going to push up inflation even more. So instead of Jerome Powell firing economists at the Fed who got this so wrong, you know, I don't believe one that's been fired now. Maybe there have been some let go. I don't know, but the Fed should tell us if they've done that. But instead of doing that, he wants 1 or 2 million Americans to lose their jobs. He wants to destroy the lives of 1 or 2 million Americans because he screwed up on the inflation call. Okay? So we have this war on the American worker. But guess what? The American workers hung in there. It's the banking system that's been taking the hit. And the banking system had been taking it because they had to buy all these treasuries because it had to do something with the money that came in. And not all of them, you know, non-money center banks, community banks, a lot of them could not hedge. In that it just wasn't a reasonable alternative for them to hedge. So now the banking system has, you know, is starting to wobble here. And it is 100%, right, because of the Fed's mismanagement of the monetary policy. Look, you would always, like I said, you're always going to have some banks failing because of mismanagement. But it doesn't happen all at once unless there is a systematic mistake that was made. And the systematic mistake that was made was the Fed blew it on inflation. Okay? So now the Fed is caught. Does it continue its war on inflation and the American worker? Or does it throw in the towel and say, you know, we cannot risk having our banking system wobble anymore? And what we've seen, I think, is two things from insiders. So let's bring this back to what we follow on a daily basis. We've seen Canadian insider buying here in the Canadian market is kind of, it's doing okay right now. Now in terms of the first quarter, it had been underperforming the U.S. In the first quarter, but Canadian insiders have been using this period to increase their buying. Our Inc. indicator, which measures the number of stocks on the TSX with key insider buying versus selling, is now over 100%. That means there's more stocks with buying than selling. And that's an interesting development because it is happening even as the Canadian market is kind of recovering here. Our Inc. Canadian Insider Index is up about 2.4% for the year. So that's thanks to this recent recovery here in the energy side. And, you know, the S&P is up 3.4%. But we'll get into the U.S. in just a second. But the key point that we're seeing here in Canada is that insiders appear to be betting that the Fed is going to have to allow inflation to run a bit hotter. And I think that makes sense because the Fed is going to have to choose here between its saving its banks and are crushing inflation. And so I don't think they're going to choose. And from what I see from insiders, they're not going to want to see more and more banking issues in the U.S. And I should say also that we're talking about the U.S. banking system. We're not talking about the Canadian bank. We're talking about the U.S. banking system. Where the insider activity in the Canadian banks is fine. They've been increasing their exposure. The Canadian situation is completely different than the U.S. situation. The two financial systems are banking systems are quite different. So the issues at hand are the U.S. Are in the U.S. banks, and the Fed is going to have to choose very soon, if they haven't already, on what they're going to do. Are they going to focus on stability, financial stability, and go slower, much slower on rate hikes and stop rate hikes likely, or even cut potentially, or are they going to continue the war on the American worker and on inflation? And I just think they're going to go and they're just going, the path of least resistance will be to stop the war on inflation and the American worker and to focus on the banking system. And to that end, you know, in terms of what we're seeing in U.S. insiders, we're seeing a big uptick, a big boost of enthusiasm for tech stocks here late in the quarter. Look, this is, in our view, probably a head fake. I think that there are lots of opportunities in the U.S. at the stock level across the board, throughout different sectors. But the opportunities are not for broad market exposure, in our view. Like our U.S. insider indicator is about 33%, whereas the Canadian one is over 100%. In the U.S., it's a big market. There's lots of opportunities within the stock level. But at the broad market level, look, the S&P 500 basically is flat for 2 years. You know, Jim, it's kind of been like going on the roller coaster at the PNE, right? You get on, you go up and you go down, and it's thrilling and it's scary. But when you stop the ride. You're at the same place where you started, and that's what's happened to the S&P 500 over the past 2 years, and we're probably in store for more of that going forward.
A friend of the show, Tim Wood, did a study, and it's called an M2, which is the immediate availability of liquid cash to you. Nothing that's tucked away for more than, say, 6 months. In other words, your savings and checking account, short-term instruments. And he said that supply has been shrinking since November, which means this inflation has not been caused by an oversupply of money, but is a supply chain problem. The Fed even said that when they started hiking rates, but they said this is the only tool we have. Well, hold on a second. Then you're using a screwdriver when perhaps a hammer should be used. Although I think in their case, they're using a hammer when a screwdriver should be used.
Well, this gets to a much bigger problem in terms of Western democratic societies and their inability, it seems, to get their heads around very complex public policy issues. I agree that it is more of a supply side issue at this point. There was a demand side issue with all the money that was pushed out the door during COVID, but I think a lot of that has been probably soaked up by now. And Tim is probably, I haven't read his study, but it makes sense to me from what you've told me. And I agree at this point, it's a supply side issue, and that's going to take time to and investments work out. And raising interest rates, you know, at this point is, well, we've talked about what the risks are to the U.S. And yeah, you know, it's the war on the American worker. It's not building, it's not expanding supply chains, right? So it's a messy situation in the U.S. right now. And that's why it's interesting to see all the dollar bulls out there talking about how the American dollar is going to come storming back here. And we will see. I'm usually agnostic on currency outlooks unless there's a really clear-cut trend and macro development that kind of staring me at the face. I just do not see the sustainable bull case for the U.S. dollar here over the next year. Look, you know, it'll have its moments of fear-driven liquidity buying, I'm sure, but boy, you know, when you just look at the challenge the Federal Reserve has, and, you know, when you look at how China and some of the is interacting now with Brazil and with the Gulf oil producers, and how you've got India and China kind of having this sort of debate as to how are we going to pay for oil outside of the U.S. dollar, not whether we should or shouldn't pay in U.S. dollars, but what is the best way not to pay in U.S. dollars? And I think this is a development that the U.S. dollar permabulls out there, and there are many of them, are missing. Like this whole petrodollar framework where, you know, in the 70s, basically the Saudis agreed, you know, to price oil in dollars so that there would be this natural demand for dollars. That's all coming at least at the margins. It's starting to fray, and it could actually evolve into something bigger. We'll have to see. I'm not predicting it. You just look at it one day at a time and you see what's happening, right? And, you know, the trend right now is not the U.S. dollar's friend, and that I'm pretty confident about. And again, it gets to this inflationary impulse that I think we see insiders betting on, and I think that's what's in store. We're in store for an interesting few months and weeks here. We've got the gold-silver ratio has come screaming off of a recent high. You know, the higher the gold-silver ratio goes, it's usually points a deflationary impulse because gold is outperforming silver. Well, we've just had a big reversal in that. So, you know, the inflation story, a lot of people are saying, I want to say that the inflation's been conquered. Yeah, is it as high as it was? Of course, it's come down. But is it done? Is it over? Are we going to deflation? I don't think so. That's not what we're seeing.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, did you see anything in the new Canadian budget that's positive?
Well, we've certainly seen the Trudeau government bet heavily on critical minerals and now nuclear power, which is interesting. The Trudeau government, of course, has never been all that enthusiastic about fossil fuels, but they've kind of laid in their mandate here, you know, in terms of, they've been in power now for almost a decade. It seems like a decade anyways. I don't think it's quite that long. But they've decided that they're going to support the critical, like the battery metals area. And what's interesting is they've come up with some new support measures in this budget. One is like for the critical mineral strategy. They've announced a new clean manufacturing tax credit, which I understand is going to be available for mining equipment. So that could be interesting. This is, and that would be for critical minerals. So I don't believe gold would qualify, but the battery mineral type, many of them would. So we're not quite sure how this is going to work yet, but it sounds like it could help in some of these in extraction of these minerals. So they're not just talking about the battery plants, and you know, it used to be all the politicians ever wanted to talk about was a new auto plant. Well, they've actually, to the Trudeau government's credit, they've actually gone down to the mining extraction level, and they're actually saying that they're going to support that. So, of course, I think at the end of the day, it's the regulatory environment that's the big who's going to move the needle there more than any government support in terms of money. But apparently, you know, they're trying to change the culture on the regulatory side too, which would be good if that in fact happens. So we'll see. There's some early signs that maybe it has. We'll keep our eyes wide open on that to see what's going on. But so there's interesting developments there, and also on the nuclear side, which is, and we actually wrote about that today in our morning report. Our signals are basically favoring kind of nuclear power infrastructure company as opposed to uranium miners. I may not make a lot of uranium bulls happy to hear that, but I mean, we are watching. There are individual mining names that do come across our screens highly, but I think it is a case by case situation on the mining side. You know, in terms of where the, you know, how the property is looking and the project's going. We haven't seen broad insider enthusiasm in the uranium mining space yet. But we are seeing some interesting signs in the actual companies that build and help build nuclear power plants. And this, there's a new refundable investment tax credit for clean electricity in the budget, and that can help build nuclear power plants. So the government has put its stamp behind nuclear energy. You know, and you compare that to Europe, where they're still trying to debate whether nuclear power should be part of the green energy strategy. I mean, you cannot make this up. But yeah, they still don't know, right? Like, France is in favor of it, Germany is opposed. They're still trying to figure their way out there on nuclear power. The U.S., really, nuclear power generation peak in 2012, but look, there's apparently a couple of nuclear power plants under construction there now, and so there are some signs even in the U.S. that the nuclear power is starting to get some traction. But it's good right here at home to see that the Canadian government has put, you know, some thought and is getting behind an industry where Canada has some expertise. So one can argue they should have probably done this a bit earlier, but they're doing it now, so that's positive.
Well, Fukushima sure didn't help having a meltdown after an earthquake. I know in the town of Peace River, which is 500 clicks north of Edmonton, they were going to build 3 atomic power plants right after, and the townspeople had approved it. Right after Fukushima happened, they voted against it. You could see why people would be nervous, although that was a plant built with 1960s equipment and regulations. Maybe we've learned a little bit since then to make it safer.
Well, exactly. And the fact of the matter is, either you believe we have a climate emergency or we don't. And if you do believe that, which is what most of our politicians, elected politicians who are in government seem to believe, at least in North America, fair enough. They got the votes. They're running the show. If you believe you have a climate emergency, it means you have to do things to get on top of the emergency. And well, we've seen how Europe has dealt with the problem, and it hasn't been very successful. So, and we do know that nuclear power does not involve, in terms of power generation, any emissions. So, the math kind of works for nuclear power. Like, it doesn't take much to figure that up. And so then it comes back, are we in a climate emergency, or are we going to worry about a lot of other things, like, how do we store the uranium after it's been spent? And, these are all important issues, but look, if you have an emergency and you believe that the planet is facing an existential crisis, all these other ancillary issues, such as how to store the spent uranium, can be dealt with. These are minor issues in the grand scheme of the climate emergency. So when I see these politicians opposing nuclear power, it's obvious to me. It's just being driven by industrial interests who oppose nuclear power, right? So you've got lobbyists on from other alternative energy sources that are trying to stop them. So it's, unfortunately, it comes down to money. That's why I think that, one has to be eyes wide open in all these debates, right? So it's just good to see in Canada we've come to our senses here, because we do have a nuclear power industry that's very capable, and it's good to see the federal government behind it.
Is Canadian lithium more valuable than lithium from a place like China or Argentina?
Well, that's a great question, because you think lithium is lithium, right? But politics can change the price of any commodity, right? And we saw that happen in the nickel market immediately after the invasion of the Ukraine, when the sanctions were thrown onto Russia. And politics, I think, is going to have an impact on the lithium market in a way that I don't think it's been fully understood. We hear a lot about lithium prices in China coming down, and I don't think anybody in the North American lithium mining space expected the big run up we saw in lithium prices in China to stick. I mean, I think everyone kind of assumed that they would come down. But what's interesting is that lithium in China, You can't export it to the U.S. and get the same tax credit under the Inflation Reduction Act as you can lithium from Canada, because it does qualify. So, in fact, I think you're going to see Canadian lithium, and we only have one producing lithium mine right now, as far as I understand, it's in Manitoba, and that production ironically goes to China. But we do have, of course, many, many mining entrepreneurs that are working very hard to develop mines and lithium extraction out of brine in Alberta and Saskatchewan. So I think we will see a lot of lithium come out of the ground. I think that's going to have an advantage, because it can qualify for Teslas and Volkswagens and built in North America and all sorts of brands, right? Not just those two, but not so much. Not at all. Lithium from Argentina and lithium from China will not qualify for those tax credits. So, You know, I think the Canada's looking pretty good in terms of its market opportunity with lithium. And I wouldn't get too phased if you hear about lithium prices coming off in China. I think this whole, the whole lithium market's going to have, is going to be defined quite differently over the next few years than what you see it now.
How's the Chinese electric vehicle market holding up, and will they be sending some of their more affordable cars to North America to people who don't want to pay $60,000 or $90,000 for an electric car? I saw an article where Volkswagen is making a car they call the Viking that goes for $10,000 in China, but they're not going to sell it here. Will we ever get affordable EVs?
Well, that, those are two very different questions. Yeah. First, you know, on the on what's going on in China, BYD, which is the big local China electric vehicle maker, it's basically saying we're ready to fight Tesla for market share, and come on, let's get this going. You know, we're going to be driving adoption. You know, I mean, they haven't spelled out what their strategy is, but it sounds like they're ready to fight Tesla in any kind of price war. Tesla's been quite a, has been dropping its prices, I believe, in China following the end of certain tax credits that ended last year in 2022. Now, there was a lot of negativity in January and February in the EV sort of mining, not necessarily mining space, but just, you know, the whole market investor sentiment around EVs and lithium and the like, because they saw in January sales fell in China. Well, because everybody rushed to buy a car in December to get the tax credits. Looks like adoption is going to keep growing in China. Looks like these automobile makers are going to compete heavily to try and get adoption. That may not be great. And I'm not making a prediction here, but it may or it may not be good for the profitability of these EV makers. We will have to see. But if it drives adoption, it's good for lithium demand, and it's good for copper demand and nickel demand. So it's positive for the Canadian mining space. I mean, I think that's the issue here. You know, the takeaway from that is that, you know, this doom and gloom we had in January and February, you know, it was misplaced. I mean, it was just so short term. So, you know, the EV market, is, I think, you know, is going to be buzzing in China and in Canada and U.S. It's, I mean, it's just getting going here, right? I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, it's just getting going. And, you know, to your other question about the cost, well, you know, that is interesting, right? Because of the subsidies, we will see if it benefits the automakers and battery makers, whether it benefits the consumer. I think the jury's still out on that. But look, you know, maybe we will get cheaper Chinese imports that may not qualify for the subsidy. I mean, we'll have to see how it works out. But in the meantime, they can export their cars to other countries, right? I mean, it's not just North America. They, you know, they can send them to Indonesia and all throughout Asia. So, you know, depending on the country, I'm sure there are trade issues country to country. But just generally speaking, you know, China has many countries it can look to for its exports, its EV exports. Whether we see them here in the streets of Toronto and Vancouver, time will tell. But I think you probably will start seeing them in different cities throughout Asia.
Anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now, Ted?
Well, I'm going to keep our eye on the Inc. Canadian Insider Index. You can get that on CanadianInsider.com. We have it there, and see if it keeps going up here and how it reacts to, you know, if we do get a boost in commodity prices here over the next few weeks. You know, we've seen oil rebound here. We're kind of expecting a spring rally, and so far so good. We'll keep our fingers crossed, and we'll see if gold and silver can keep going through some key levels here, and if the gold silver ratio, which you can also track on Canadian Insider, continues to head down. You know, then we're off to the races.
Ted, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca. Find him online at CanadianInsider.com. If you have any questions for Ted, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com and we will ask that question for you. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.